First case this morning is State v. Boyd.
Good morning. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. May it please the court, Lila Silverstein on behalf of Jason Boyd. There are a few issues in this case, but I assume the court would like to focus on the ex post facto violation, and please, we can talk about the other issues if we have time. The application.
Our main question would be what your response is to Enquist.
Sure. Well, in Enquist, Division 2 followed the result in Ward without acknowledging that these obligations have become so much more onerous. The obligations have increased exponentially, and you can't. You have to reevaluate a statute when that happens. For instance, in all of those out-of-state cases I cited, those original or the first generation registration statutes in those states had been upheld against ex post facto challenges, but the amended statutes did not because they became punitive as they were amended. And the same is true here. I mean, back in 1994, when the Supreme Court decided Ward, homeless people did not have to register at all, right? And people with homes simply had to send in their address information when they changed addresses. But now, homeless people do have to register, and in fact, they have to register in person every single week. And so the statute is now punitive.
And but that had been adopted in Enquist, though.
Right. But they didn't really step through the proper analysis as demonstrated. And to be fair, they really didn't have the guidance from all of these other cases because most of them were decided subsequent to Enquist. But in all of these other cases...
All of these other, aren't there two?
No, I cited several, Your Honor.
That are post-Enquist?
Maybe only two of them were post-Enquist. All of them were fairly recent. So there was an Oklahoma case, there was a case out of Maine, a case out of New Hampshire, a case out of Michigan, maybe a couple of others that I cited. All of them were in the last few years. I think several post-dated Enquist, pardon me. But in any event, as I mentioned, in all of those cases, those courts found that their amended registration statutes were punitive and could not be applied retroactively without running afoul of the ex post facto clause. And that was in large part due to the adoption of in-person reporting requirements. And it was true, even though at worst, in these other amended statutes around the country, people were required to check in quarterly. In other words,
homeless people or everybody?
Well, everybody, or certain subsets. I mean, each of these statutes is slightly different, but at worst, in all of them, there was a quarterly in-person registration obligation, meaning people had to check in, obviously, four times per year. But under our amended statute, homeless people must check in person 52 times per year, right?
Don't some of the other cases you're relying on have more onerous requirements like give us all your registered vehicles, your license plate numbers, your email address, that kind of stuff? Wasn't that also not just the in-person, but the level of information you had to provide?
Yeah, the level of information was part of it. There were other factors as well, like the determination of risk or the lack of individualized risk assessment and that sort of thing. And it is sort of a totality of circumstances analysis, but our statute has some similar problems to those as well. For example, homeless people are subject to supervision, which is akin to probation and parole. And all homeless people have their faces and crimes put online, whereas for other people, it depends on your risk assessment, right? So only level 2 and 3 are online, whereas for homeless people, everyone's online. For homeless people, everyone has to check in weekly. There's no differentiation among risk levels, and that was also part of the analysis in these other cases. But the most important amendment to our statute, again, is this weekly in-person reporting requirement. I mean, I looked at a lot of statutes and cases from around the country, and I don't think any even approaches ours in terms of that level of burden. That, I think, is by far the most onerous statute in the nation. And
doesn't this leave us in a situation? I mean, there can be so many variations among states or how you would draw the statute. I mean, does this kind of a challenge put us in the position of saying, well, 26 times a year wouldn't be too bad, or once a month or once a quarter is okay, but, you know, 52 times is too much? Or, you know, if you differentiate by risk assessment for the homeless in the same way that you did for others, then that would be okay, but the way they've done it isn't. So I mean, I feel like in some way we're being drawn into drafting the statute.
Well, no, you're just being drawn into saying it can't be applied to people whose crimes predated these amendments, right? And to be clear, that's all I'm asking this court to hold, is that these amendments cannot be applied to Mr. Boyd and to people similarly situated. So we're talking about people whose crimes were at least 18 years ago and who are homeless. And so it's for that narrow class of people that this statute can't be applied. There's nothing. Well, I shouldn't say this. In another case, I might come back and say there's some other problem. But for purposes of today's argument, there's nothing else wrong with the statute, and these provisions can be applied to everyone whose crimes postdated their enactment, which was in 1999 or 2000, right?
So if I, and Mr. Boyd, your client, his only crime, right, was the crime that was 18 years ago.
Yes. Well, his only sex offense was when he was 23 years old. He had sex with a 15-year-old. It's, you know, what we used to call statutory rape. And that was his only sex offense. He's had a lot of failure to register since then, because even though he's registered dozens upon dozens upon dozens of times, if you're homeless, it's so hard to not miss a week or two here and there. And the other thing that happens that makes this so onerous is that every time you fail, the clock resets from zero. So his obligation was supposed to be 10 years, but it's a de facto lifetime obligation for homeless people. That end date is illusory, because nobody can go every single week for 10 years without missing a couple weeks here and there, and then you're slapped with the crime. You're slapped with failure to register.
And under your argument, if Mr. Boyd reoffended at any time after June 1999, he'd still be back on the reporting requirement. Is that right?
Yes. If he committed another registrable offense that postdated the enactment of these amendments, I would not be making this argument. Certainly. Absolutely. Right. It's only because his crime was so long ago, and he's homeless. And so, and because the amendments that apply to homeless people are so onerous as to be punitive, they cannot be applied retroactively. And so the application of these amendments to Mr. Boyd violated the ex post facto clause, and for that reason, the conviction on count one should be reversed and dismissed with prejudice. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Eric Peterson from the Skagit County Prosecutor's Office, representing the state of Washington. I think before we can even get to answer the question of whether or not there's an ex post facto violation and look at this analysis, you have to look at the date of violation and date of conviction for Mr. Boyd's prior conviction for rape in the third degree. And you see the date of violation, the date of the sentencing is July 29th of 1999. It was June 7th of 1999 that the registration changes came into effect that applied to transit registrations. So this whole argument with respect to whether or not the transit registrations have created a more onerous burden is not applicable to Mr. Boyd's situation, because at the time that he was sentenced, he was subject to the 1999 changes of the law.
Does ex post facto refer to the date the crime was committed as opposed to when it was sentenced? And isn't this whole confusion about sentencing
it applies
the subject of the other assignment of error in this case?
The state's position is it applies from the date of sentencing, because that's when the restraints come into effect. He had no restraint until he was convicted and when he was sentenced.
Okay, but I'm just talking about case law. My understanding has always been that it's the date the crime is committed. And so, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but
my understanding is actually from the date of the sentencing, because that's
your understanding, but authority that you're relying on, could you please state?
Well, I think neither side provided my. I know defense didn't provide authority on that, and I don't believe I provided So, Authority, I'll be glad to look up a case or two and provide a quick cite to the court, and maybe counsel can do likewise. But that was a position I laid forth in my brief, and I didn't receive a reply that indicated that position was incorrect or inappropriate. So, I mean, if we are looking at a situation where...
So is that why... So one of the other issues in the case is there was this two-convict instruction that mentioned the July date as the date of to which the registration statute applied, right? And there's an assignment of error because that was included seemingly as an element of the crime.
Right.
But then there was no skirmish below about whether that, because I thought it was like your fourth amended information you originally had at the date of conviction or some other date, and then you changed it to the date of sentencing?
It was the prosecutor handled the case, and if you look at it, actually, here's has the date of the guilty plea in the prior case. You see it says plea. So it was May 27th, 99 was the actual date of the guilty plea. And if you look from the date of guilty plea, the statutes that would have been effect at the time would have been known. I mean, the legislators, so I'm kind of mixing the issues. Your Honor has gone to the issue of the amended information and the proof that was provided in the case with respect to the date of conviction. And the state's position is that as of any day after May 27th of 1999, he was convicted of the charge of rape of a child in the third degree. Now, the prosecutor changed the date to the date of sentencing to July 29th of 1999 as the date that the defendant was convicted. Well, he was convicted, if you looked at the term of conviction, from May 27th and 99. So the state's position, we adequately proved, put the wrong date, so to speak, for the date of conviction, but that didn't change whether or not he was convicted of a charge of rape of a child in the third degree. And in fact, the offense on page 3-1...
So you agree that there's a temporal element. I mean, in other words, it has to be a previous conviction?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's what we...
So you... But the date of conviction that you put in the two-convict construction was the wrong date. So if that is the wrong date, and it isn't an element, what is... Do we delete that date from the...
It's a surplus element. You get into the mistachio.
But do we look at it in our analysis about whether this is a Tyler case or a Hickman case or whatever it is? Do we just delete that from the from our picture of what the information, I mean, the two-convict instruction said?
Well, it's an unnecessary element the state needed to prove. We proved that date of conviction. So if you look at it as far as we charged it, we have to prove it. We proved it. Now the question is, was he convicted as of May 20th?
Was the jury instructed on the temporal element? Did the two-convict instruction contain the past tense? In other words, it was a prior conviction, but it wasn't July 70, or I mean, 9.
Well, he was convicted July. As of the date. He was convicted on July 30th of 1999, and every date since that. I mean, it's the date of conviction or the date, a date which from which he was convicted. Now, the prosecutor handling the case was under the impression that since we rely on the date of sentencing for so many other facts with respect to it, so she believed that was appropriate. But in hindsight, the date of conviction for the purpose of whether or not a conviction exists would be the date of the guilty plea or the jury or judge finding of guilt.
And that's true under the registration statute. 0.130 is... depends on somebody that has been found to have committed or has been convicted of a sex offense.
Right.
Required. So the conviction is what triggers it.
The conviction triggers it, and the conviction occurred before the date that we proved that he had been convicted, because, I mean, the date we alleged he had been convicted, but he had been convicted. So we have established that element in this case. And, in fact, defense admitted during the closing argument that the state has proven that Mr. Boyd is a convicted sex offender, and that he was convicted in 1990 of an offense. So as far as the element of that crime, in the statutory element of that crime, it was proven. As far as the element of, as we charged it and as we instructed the jury, we proved the facts as it was charged and instructed. So the state's position is there is no error there with respect to establishing the date of conviction.
What was charged in the instruction? I mean, in the information, I can't remember.
The state amended the information during trial from the date of May 27th to the July 29th of 1990 date. So that was the amendment that happened mid-trial, and that was caused the comment by the judge. Well, I'm thinking your conviction date is actually the day that the plea happens. The prosecutor went ahead with it. The state's position, it didn't change the fact that you look at the conviction here, and have we proven all the elements that are necessary for failure to register?
Let's go back to issue one, then, because I kind of got you off track there by getting into this business about, I mean, in other words, your first line of defense is, we don't even have an ex post facto case because at the time he was sentenced, the statute was already in effect. So we can disagree about that possibly, but let's just say, what's plan B here? So your argument is, rely on Enquist, end of story.
Well, you have to go back to look at Ward and Enquist, and look at the fact that even under the Martinez-Mendoza factors that you look at, you look at that if there is no clear legislative expression of intent of whether or not it's ex post facto. And here there's a clear legislative.
Realistically, as counsel did. I mean, we have a guy here who was convicted 18 years ago when he was 23 years old of raping a 15-year-old. He has committed no crime since then except for failure to register. Due to the amendment that followed, he now has to, for the rest of his life, to the extent that he remains homeless, he has to go every week, 52 times a year, in person, and register. No vacations.
Actually, he was convicted of another offense other than failure to register since the date. But I understand the underlying question is, it's difficult for a person to maintain the status of homeless registration such that it becomes a burden on them and that they can't ever come out from under. And, Your Honor, doing that is making an assumption that a person who, at the time they register as homeless or transient registration, is not going to ever be able to meet the obligations. We don't know that that's the case. We don't have any statistics about how often that particular situation applies. But if you look at the fact that
he's had like two or three weeks when he missed, and then that gets him back under this obligation, which he should have been able to get rid of in 10 years under Ward. But, in fact, he wouldn't have even been required to register under Ward. But let's just say that he was then, as a homeless person, required to register in some way once a year, once a quarter, but every week.
Well, then you talk about the fact that from the bench,
ex post facto. I mean,
well, but you have a situation where Tyler already determined that weekly transit registration is not an ex post facto violation. So I think you have to look at it from that underlying perspective. I may have spoke. I'm sorry. So you have to look at you actually have to go against the court decision in Enquist to reach a different conclusion. And we're not talking any change since 1999. The defense is arguing has increased the burden. And you look at the burden that exists in other states, and I think the other states that we were talking about had a lot of burdens that involved a permanent lifetime registration without the ever having the ability to be relieved of the burden, and also involved more significant factors or things that they need to provide. So this position is the court should affirm the convictions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. There's no dispute in any of the cases that it's the date of the crime that's relevant. I cited Ward and Weaver versus Graham, but every single case says it's the date of the crime. So this is from Ward citing Calder versus Bull. A law violates the ex post facto prohibition if it changes the punishment and inflicts a greater punishment than the law annexed to the crime when committed. It is the date of the crime that applies and not the date of sentencing. That's well settled. In terms of the dates of these other cases relative to Enquist, at least three of the cases that I cited postdated Enquist. That was Doe versus Snyder, which was the Sixth Circuit case, Doe v. State, which was the New Hampshire case, and Starkey, which was the Oklahoma case. And in all of those cases, as I mentioned, one of the main reasons that they found that their amended statutes were punitive and were subject to the ex post facto clause was because of the addition of an in-person registration requirement. And for each of them, Again, as I mentioned, at worst, people had to register quarterly. So this weekly reporting obligation for homeless people is, I believe, by far the most onerous in the nation, and therefore it is punitive. And again, that just means that it can't be applied retroactively to homeless people. That means to homeless people who committed their crimes before 1999. Okay? And in terms of the Hickman issue, my primary argument there, it was not to get into this dispute about whether we need to follow Hickman or Musacchio in general, but there is a critical difference here in that the information was also amended, and the Musacchio court left that question open. They said that they were leaving open the question of whether the same result would occur if the charging document were also amended. So since the U.S. Supreme Court did not reach that issue, Hickman clearly controls in this circumstance. Thank you.
Thank you.